Diane, it's 2:18 p.m.
Welcome to the second episode of Twin Peaks Speaks. We're going to be covering Traces to Nowhere.
Now, I just call it episode one. I don't buy into these fancy titles with words in them.
I know, from when it was aired in Germany, right?
I think it was Germany.
Yeah, that's when they... I don't know who gave them the titles, though. That was never clear to me.
Yeah, well, I think Traces to Nowhere is a good title.
Yeah, it's a fine title.
Anyway. I am Matt Olson, your sidekick, I would say, for this.
And I'm Ashley Brandt, and I guess I'm not the sidekick.
No, I mean, I am definitely the Watson to your Twin Peaks Sherlock here.
Then I guess I'm Special Agent Dale Cooper.
Well, in a way, yeah. You can make that connection.
And they do in that episode. So let's start with some revival news.
Ooh.
So David Lynch, speaking to the students in his David Lynch MA film course, confirmed that the revival will be shot on digital and expressed an artistic preference for digital over celluloid.
Hmm.
So that's not really surprising if you're looking at the landscape of TV, but I think naturally some Twin Peaks fans will be disappointed.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's getting harder and harder, and I'm talking about this not even from like a prosumer level. I've never myself worked with film, though I do have some inklings, some opinions about it. I think it's getting harder from an enthusiast level to even muster a real, like, it's gotta be film, because these days you can do so much with digital cameras and a lot of not just like technology but like sheer artistry, and like care is being put into making those systems, and it's not a surprise that for practical reasons and for like genuine like, no, I like the way this looks, I like what we can do with it now reasons, that any TV show, it's going to be a hard sell to put it on film. And the reason to do it would be to just kind of have that like, yeah, we made it on film.
Yeah,
look at
us.
That
would be the only reason to do it.
Yeah, David's MA class on film. That's what a
incredible.
Special bunch. Yeah,
incredible. Fun fact: did you know that Breaking Bad was one of the last shows to be shot on film, but now Better Call Saul is being shot on digital?
Hmm, I didn't know that.
Yeah,
I actually didn't.
Yeah. In their podcast, they had, I believe, one of their cinematographers, a director of cinematography, talking about kind of the changeover and also expressing a preference. They actually were able to, like, add clouds to scenes.
Yeah. Yeah. There's just...
As opposed to just, like, laying a filter over a shot and being like, all right, that's it. That's all we can do.
So that's what it looks like. Yeah. No, I think it also reminds me of the frame rate debate for big screen movies, where it's just like I actually get that more.
Mm-hmm.
You know, double versus half the frame rate, and it's like, one, you're very used to seeing, and it just kind of speaks, you know, to it being filmic in quality, and the other not. But the benefits there in terms of, you know, matching one-to-one with what you want to do it with effects, or looking good on particular systems, or like, you know, especially like home entertainment systems or new digital projection systems in theaters, it just like, it gets harder and harder to justify using older tech unless you really know how to make it look right. Like, of course, if that's what you know and you can make it look fantastic that way and you can't the other way, that's the direction you go with. But I think we could trust that if David Lynch is enthusiastic about doing things one way, he's probably not gonna, at least technically, he's probably not gonna screw it up, you know?
Yeah. I mean, the tides have really turned towards digital. But the other thing that I think will be interesting is the revival will probably be widescreen. It won't be...
I have been thinking about that.
...three aspect ratio that we're seeing...
Well, I mean, it won't be the first time we've seen the world of Twin Peaks in widescreen, though, either. You know, we have 2 hours of movie to analyze. And actually, I will say, you haven't seen that movie. Again,
no,
we can
I
come
haven't.
Back to the fact that there's quite a lot of this you haven't seen. And it's not a spoiler to say, I only came to Fire Walk with Me years after I'd originally seen this show. I held off on it. I'm not exactly sure why. I think part of it was out of hope that we'd be in the position we are now, where it's like, oh, now we're going to get more show. I don't know. In the meantime, I'll save this little morsel, which turned out to be kind of different in tone.
Yeah.
And one of the things that struck me as different was how it looked. Because it looks widescreen and in other ways too, very different from the show. There's some things that, you know, we can start to talk about today in terms of, I guess either cinematography or just, I'm not that much of an expert, mm-hmm. so we can just say style techniques that mm-hmm. just are used throughout the show.
Yeah.
And the movie kind of, to me, from what I remember, changes things up
mm-hmm.
and it adopts its own characteristics that are, of course, still very much in, you know, Lynch's wheelhouse.
Right.
And feel appropriate to the different feel of the movie.
Mm-hmm.
But definitely, I think maybe for the audiences at the time, maybe some of the response, which we'll get to weeks and weeks from now, may have thrown them off as well as just the content of the film.
Yeah, but, absolutely. So it'll be interesting to see how much of the previous aesthetic is retained in the revival, especially understanding that technically we will be working with different technology, digital widescreen.
Yeah.
So inherently we're going to have those differences already present in the revival. And then from there, what measures are going to be taken to preserve the existing aesthetic, or how will it be advanced and transformed?
Yeah. I honestly wouldn't be too surprised and would be very interested to see if the new show ends up looking more like, or also in just in tone, because it won't be restricted to the network television rules.
Uh-huh.
If, you know, tone or content wise, it ends up resembling Fire Walk With Me more. But
that's true.
We can talk about that in the future. Is that all you got for revival news? No.
That is my only revival news. The news from David Lynch's MA film course.
Yeah. No news on casting or when they're going to start.
No. Technically, it sounds like Kyle MacLachlan is still the only person on the cast who signed a contract. It sounds like most other cast members have spoken with David Lynch at this point and are expecting to be part of the revival, but at this point Kyle's the only one who signed a contract.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Still in this limbo.
Especially considering the amount of work that like Sherilyn Fenn put in into like
yeah.
her like beautiful Facebook campaign to like bring David back. Like, she deserves all the kudos in the world and a huge signing bonus.
Oh yeah.
In my opinion.
Absolutely.
What a hero. Interesting that so many strong women in the cast just are waiting in contractual limbo at this point.
We will see how this resolves. Hopefully soon. I was just checking in on other things that have started filming today, movies and TV shows starting. And I'm just thinking to myself, like, okay, you know, and they're set to come out 2016, 2017. This TV show's gotta get a move on.
Yeah, I mean, they said they're going to start filming in the fall.
Hmm. Okay.
So
we'll
really
be
any day now.
We'll be somewhere around season 2 by then, and yeah, nice.
Yeah,
we'll go up to North Bend.
Yeah, we'll take our trip. All right, so episode 2, or Traces to Nowhere, opens up with the incredible shot of Cooper upside down in his hotel room talking to Diane.
Yep.
And I think that shot establishes so much about Cooper and his strangeness.
Yeah. I think about that. I think they parodied that when Kyle was a guest on SNL, which is something we should talk about. We should pull up that clip at some point. But the weird boot attachments he has. Like, I like that it's not a strength thing. It kind of...
It actually is.
Is it?
Yeah. So the dismount that he does is like all from his core. That takes
A
lot of strength.
I was thinking of just like...
Just the hanging.
I think that just the hanging, if that was just being done with like, I don't know, feet or something, it would... It, there's just something about the image. Also, his finely starched underwear.
Yes.
The boxers that are standing straight up somehow.
Oh my God.
The whole picture to me, and that it's clearly part of his morning routine.
Yeah.
Like he must have been so excited to see this horizontal pipe in his room when he got there, or even maybe requested a room with one, an exposed pipe. It's part of his like boot up sequence, basically. Put these like metal clasps on, do my hang, record my morning message for Diane.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, as we'll see, is next episode Zen?
Yeah.
Zen, et cetera,
Zen,
et cetera.
The skills to cut the skills art, to catch a killer.
I think is it art to catch a killer? No. I don't know. Anyway.
I was looking at it last night and I was like, it's almost the title of Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance, but it's not.
Ah, okay.
I think there's a word change, but I'm not 100% sure.
Anyway, that's next episode, but you get more of Cooper's either motivation or his, like, the base that informs his, like, every action there. But this also establishes that, where it's just like, this is how he wakes up in the morning.
Yeah. Well, and I mean, this is an obvious point, but I think it's worth stating that, like, he is literally putting himself in oppositional orientation to the rest of the world. He's, like, defying gravity. And I think that really, like, says a lot about, like, him as like a force in this town, his like orientation as a character, and like what we're gonna see of him in the future.
Yeah, gravity defying boxers.
Yeah,
very heavy symbolism.
Yes. Hope to see that in the revival too.
Yeah,
recurring motif.
I swear, if there are floppy underwear in the revival, I'm out.
Yes.
Yeah. 0 stars.
And then he says this incredible line, what really went on between Marilyn Monroe and the Kennedys and who really pulled the trigger on JFK? Because this is something that he wonders in the mornings and that he's asking Diane. But what I thought was really interesting, what struck me, is it's sort of almost anti-X-Files, that statement, because he's not a part of this grand conspiracy that's covering up what really happened in that situation in this fictional universe. And he's also not, you know, drinking the Kool-Aid and just accepting the narrative that's been given to him. He is an outsider and he is in a position to wonder about these things.
It almost gives me the sense that, and I mean, at other points that he, at other points, and so he can kind of exhibit this too, of while being totally invested in the here and now of the town and of sorting this out, his mind can just run wild. And that's like, that's like file away for a later date when this is resolved and I can go investigate this thing on my own time.
Ooh, is that going to be the season 3 plot? Is he going to be investigating?
Yeah, I mean, if they want a new direction, sure. They could get Greg Kinnear to play JFK in flashbacks.
Yeah, yeah, I'm really into that. David, are you listening?
Hello! I have filed this idea away. Thank you very much. Have a good one.
I think
that was great. We just had a guest appearance. So strange. He came to us in a vision, and luckily neither of us started screaming like Grace Zabriskie.
Oh, so, you heard that too. Good. Okay. But David, if you want us to write up that spec script, you know where to find us.
Yeah, on Twitter. We'll give it to you in 140 character chunks.
It's a new medium. Not unlike digital. And then we go to Cooper getting his coffee, which he's super hyped about. And then we see Audrey Horn in her most iconic sweater. The, like, lavender tree sweater.
Mm-hmm.
Which no one has ever ID'd and no one has ever recreated. So that's another hope for the revival. I would buy that.
A challenge to both the, you know, costume people on the revival, but also to cosplayers. See if you can match that cardigan. I dare you to.
It's a beautiful item. And here we get Audrey and Dale's sort of first flirtation.
Yeah. Yeah. I have some complicated feelings about that.
Yeah.
Both in the way that this relationship between Audrey and Cooper plays out, you know, through the rest of the show.
Mm-hmm.
And as we'll talk about at some point down the line, what the writers were thinking, what the crew was thinking about it. But I'm trying to divorce myself of what I know about the future and know about the course of this relationship.
Mm-hmm.
There's still as kind of, oh, I don't know. I don't want to use a tacky word, but electrifying, let's say, as this first encounter is. It's still kind of weird because we get Audrey in the world. Like, to me, Audrey has not yet done... She has shown her independence. She has shown that she does not move in step with the rest of Twin Peaks High School.
Uh-huh.
But it's still very much of that world. And I get kind of heebie-jeebies a little bit.
I mean, because of the...
Because of the age gap.
Okay, good.
Just like, just purely that, you know, I know there are people, this is like, you know... I don't know if you've run across the term ship on the alt.twinpeaks forums. I don't know when that was coined, but this was definitely that for some people. And I see why. And it's, you know, it's not like it's a thing that's not there in the show.
Uh-huh.
That's just coming out of nowhere. But at the same time, I don't know. It's harder for me to look at this plot line without being like, but... Dale, you don't get away with this just because you're weird.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, a lot of people have excused it by saying it's a fictional show, which I say bullshit.
Yeah.
But, and I mean, we know the goodness of Dale Cooper, so we know that he's not...
he's not a predator.
But...
he's not... Yeah.
When you have that sort of age dynamic, those relationships can be very predatory, but there's also just like an inherent power dynamic between someone who's still in high school, who's still under the thumb of her parents, and someone
who's an adult with an established
career and financial power.
I don't know if Audrey's quite under the thumb of her parents, because she just fucked up Ben's business deal so bad.
As true as that is, she lives in their home.
Yeah.
She's financially dependent on them.
Yeah. There's not many other places she could go in Twin Peaks at this point. With the possible exception of, I guess, anybody's house. Because everybody lives in big, beautiful houses with the exception of Shelley and Leo. Yeah.
Poor things.
Yeah.
But the other weird thing I was thinking about this in the pilot is that Shelley and Bobby also have that similar dynamic. And obviously, it's not totally the same because sort of the gender and age dynamics are flipped. But it's also... pretty inappropriate.
Hmm.
You know, I wouldn't want to date a high school quarterback now at the age of 22.
Because Shelley is a couple years out.
Yeah.
Hmm.
And, yeah, I mean, it's less of a gap, but it's still...
I was having this conversation with friends the other day about... this is just in a kind of general... totally separate from Twin Peaks postgrad ennui. What is the right age you and I as 22-year-olds can date right now? You're 22, right?
Yeah, I'm 22.
Just checking. And they were saying, oh, you could date. They did like the half plus seven rule.
No.
And I think that would come up with, in our case, 18. But I think my friends were saying you could date a 19-year-old. And I was like, No, I couldn't. I would at this point say, now that I am out of the college environment, I need to be able to go out with someone and get a drink. And if that means they're 20 and have a fake, that might fly. But otherwise, we gotta be in lockstep. I can't go too much further below. But this isn't a show about who is and isn't right to date based on your age, except for all the parts where it will be that.
A gratuitous part of every episode, yeah.
So you wrote a big old thesis in college on Lolita.
I did.
So you do have some, like, some, you have some very strong feelings about how these kind of relationships are portrayed in fiction, whether on screen or on page, what have you.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Well, I guess I'll just put it this way, and we can see how this evolves as we rewatch the show, but do you ship Audrey and Cooper?
I would ship Audrey and Cooper in, like, 4 years or something like that.
Once Audrey matured?
Yeah. I mean, I would want her to not, like, turn 18 mm-hmm. and then shack up with Dale. Like, I don't think that would be appropriate.
Yeah.
That would be going from, like, basically from her dad to Dale. And I don't think that that's good for, you know, your growth and development as a human being. I would want her to spend a couple years doing her own thing.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe chilling with Dale. Maybe they make out a little bit. That's chill. But, like...
Maybe they make out a little bit, like, in my fan fiction I wrote.
Exactly. But, no, I would, like, love to see Audrey, like, being her own person.
Yeah. Well, I can see that. Okay.
Yeah.
Good. I'm glad I wasn't the only one who's gonna just be like, yeah, I don't know. A lot of Twin Peaks fans are very much pro this relationship and invested in it.
Yeah.
And then they have feelings about it later on as the plot develops and so forth. That just...
I mean, I think their chemistry is, like, incredible. But it's also one of those situations where I think that, like, it is just right to think that Dale would be uncomfortable, and rightly so. And if he's not, then that's a huge red flag.
And as amazing as that chemistry is, you can't just... And amazing a character as Dale Cooper is, you can't just be like, he's so cool, he gets a pass for, you know, being flirtatious. Like, it's weird. It's weird. Anyway, that's the Great Northern.
Yeah, but just going back to Shelley and Bobby for a second, I don't think I've ever read anything where anyone pointed out that age difference. And like I said, it's not... The age difference isn't as great. You know, there's this kind of flip in gender and power dynamics, although I think Bobby is still very domineering.
Shitty quarterback. I
wonder, like, did they know each other in high school? Was he, like, a freshman and she was, like, a senior? Is that the situation?
So... I always get confused on this, and I don't know if it's stated explicitly in the show, so you can tell me if it is or not, and I've just missed it. So Shelley is 21, 22 at this point?
I don't know. It's...
Because I was, you know, at various points I've been under the impression, like, yeah, Shelley's got to be a couple years out, or maybe, you know, Shelley dropped out, like, junior, senior year, and
That's
only
possible.
Is, like, 1 or 2 years
That's
out.
Possible.
But I think you're right, and I'm not sure, you know... Now I'm not sure where I got it from, but that she is at least a little bit older, like a little bit further
That's
out than
always the sense that I've had.
Bobby. Okay, so maybe we're both going off of complete gut feeling here, and they're actually completely age matched. Well, I think it's one thing that we can say in terms of age, and again, this is gonna be a huge chunk of a couple episodes. Age and power dynamics here is that Leo's definitely in his mid-20s.
Or older. He's not looking so good.
You know, there's this great collection of images. Anyone can pull it up. I think just, you know, basically type in Google Twin Peaks fashion.
Yes. Oh my God, those pictures.
Yeah, where they get the cast together, because I mean, you know, it wasn't just the, you know, the standouts. Everybody in the cast. Well, one, it's a pretty good looking cast.
Yeah.
Just generally, you know, conventional good looks, all that, and so they were like the It cast, and there's this great photo shoot that they did where they're all wearing stuff totally unlike what their characters would wear.
It really looks like it's from a Delia's catalog in the 90s.
Just the style of the time. And there are these ones of who's Leo? Is that Eric? I'm gonna look this up on my phone. Anyway, seeing Leo in something other than his, and I will say it, stereotypically, you know, very rough sketch of, like, an abuser type clothes, where mm-hmm. it's just like he has the gross ponytail and is always looking schlubby and like he's about to try and, like, break a table in half. I'll say this, Leo's not a very nuanced character here in these first couple episodes.
Yeah.
He is being played straight up as the unhinged, violent one who strikes fear in his business partners mm-hmm. and spouse, and also also just like, you know, like as like a viewer, you know that either he's involved substantially with the crime afoot mm-hmm. with Laura's death, or is being set up to be like the biggest red herring just because he's yeah. always accompanied yeah. by the shit your pants music and always being very scary.
The alt.tv forums have some thoughts on that we'll come to in a little bit.
So anyway, but, age dynamics, do we have anything more to say about that?
Not really. I was just going to say that from what I read, it sounds like, so the director for this episode is Dwayne Dunham.
Yes.
Was one of the four episodes written by David Lynch. So it's the pilot, this episode, the next episode, and the season two opener
okay.
that were written by Lynch. But it was the director, David Dunham, who had edited the pilot and became the director for this episode, who suggested the flirtation between Audrey and Cooper.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. I also came across that. Are you familiar with what else Dwayne Dunham has done?
Yes, I looked that up.
Homeward Bound?
Homeward Bound, Halloween Town.
Halloween Town, I think.
13th year.
I think Halloween Town is for folks of our age who had the Disney Channel growing up, a kind of cornerstone film.
Oh, 100%.
Every year, come, you know, well, more like late September, really. But, yeah. you know, come October, you flip past the Disney Channel, they're like, yo, we're running Halloween Town or one of its sequels, like, every night.
Yeah.
Like, you cannot escape it.
Yeah.
And that's Dwayne Dunham.
Yeah.
Who also served as editor on a couple David Lynch films.
Uh-huh.
And I believe was editor for a couple episodes of Twin Peaks because he got an Emmy for it.
He did, yeah.
And
David Lynch actually poached Dwayne Dunham from another editing project to edit Wild at Heart. And basically the sort of cherry on top that was supposed to make him jump projects was the opportunity to direct this episode.
Also, he was an editor on Star Wars Return of the Jedi, which is a movie David Lynch had been tapped to direct.
Interesting.
Yeah, did you know that?
I didn't know that he'd been tapped to direct that, no.
He tells a story about going out on a car ride in George Lucas's like convertible, and George is trying to get him to sign on for, I guess at that point, Revenge of the Jedi or whatever. Yeah. I don't know exactly when this happens relative to Dune, but I think it might have been pre-Dune. But just imagine there's this YouTube video someone made of like the David Lynch edition of Return of the Jedi.
Oh my
and
God,
there's a bunch
wow.
of
wow, wait, why haven't you
I
sent
mean,
me that already?
I recognize a lot of the kind of stylistic Lynch jokes they make in it uh-huh. because a lot of them are like based heavily off of Twin Peaks.
Yeah.
I don't think it's someone who's it's a funny video. I don't think it's someone who was going to be able to craft a very subtle David Lynch does Star Wars joke. But anyway, yeah. It's worth checking out.
Wow.
That's our Dwayne
really
Dunham
funny.
Facts for today.
Wow.
I think he does a really good job, and this is something that the show will have its successes and failures with, of matching and working in David's style or in the vision for the show
yeah,
with this episode.
Totally. Probably because he's, you know, such a formative Lynch collaborator.
Yeah.
But
there's a mention of the kind of red tint to most of the scenes in the episode.
Mm-hmm.
And this is all stuff you can find online. Great
Sounds
Twin
like
Peaks
we
resources
went
out
to
there.
The same Wikipedia page.
Well, also, I mean, there's so many Twin Peaks fan sites. Really,
yeah.
if you do want to get lost for a while, watch an episode and then just search its name on
mm-hmm,
Google
mm-hmm.
and read through all the fan site kind of responses
yeah,
and
head down that rabbit
notes
hole.
And so forth. Just yeah, waste a couple hours. That's what we do.
Mm-hmm.
But that stylistic choice lends warmth to even
yeah,
the most
coral filter.
Yeah, even the most like scary, discomforting scenes in this episode have it applied to it, which
yeah.
is again something like the, you know, soap opera being turned on its head, which comes up as, you know, a point of analysis for the show so much.
Mm-hmm.
that it's not like, it doesn't do that for its regular scenes and then take it away when it wants to be scary.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, it's always there. And that's what I feel like kind of creates some of that, I don't know, dissonance or like sense of disruption that people feel. That's very intentional, obviously.
Mm-hmm. Totally. Totally. I was just thinking about some of Audrey's lines as well, when she says to Cooper, "Sometimes I get so flushed, it's interesting, your palms ever itch?" Those sentences do not make a ton of sense. So, let's just, like, if someone just said that to me, I would be very confused about what they were trying to convey. But Sherilyn Fenn is so charismatic and mm-hmm. has such just, like, an aura around her of just, like, charmingness that, like, I'm willing to accept that.
You want to be flirted with by Audrey Horne. Okay. You're 22. I'm going to say that's creepy. So.
Oh, that's true. I gotta wait.
Yeah, you gotta wait. So, I mean, okay. So far, this has been the Cooper and Audrey podcast. There are other people still living that's their true. Lives in the town of Twin Peaks.
I mean,
some of whom need to be questioned, like our leather jacketed boy, James Hurley, who's been taken in.
Oh, James.
Oh, James. James, who...
The saddest boy in all of Twin Peaks.
Yeah, definitely that. And... His weepy eyes when he's being questioned by Cooper about the necklace, and then the flashback to Laura giving him
his soft filter.
I wrote down, you were interested in Audrey's lines. I was interested in the lines that made me laugh the hardest this episode. And now I've misplaced my notes. There we go. James asking Laura, why is it that she's so happy? Because your sin is so soft.
Your sin is so soft.
Your sin is so soft. No, because your skin is so soft and you smell so good.
It sounds like he's talking to a child.
It's like it's
a puppy.
It's lines like this that make the Donna James plot work better for me, because this one little glimpse we get in to Laura and James's relationship, where James is just like, you know, not sad boy James, but this like grinning, like, I am just like a mess of really bad platitudes and like almost pickup lines boy. I at least like that around Donna, as smiley as he is, he also can just be sad boy James. Like, then I believe it. Then I believe it. Because on his own, he's sad boy James.
Yeah.
But you see around Laura, he's this, like just really, like, cringy goofball.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah, cornball. And Donna does Laura so dirty.
Yeah.
That whole,
oh, my God.
I'm, like, trying to watch out for my best friend, trying to, like, keep this relationship a secret. She's dead. The next day, she turns around. Donna turns around, and she's like, really, this whole time, it was about me and James. It was not about my best friend, who was going through some real tough shit, and is dead.
Mm-hmm.
It's about me and James from here on out.
Yeah. Everybody in this episode seems to be... I mean, now the initial day one shock is gone, and you get a lot more... mention, I think, or it stands out a lot more to me, the mention of everybody knew Laura was going through some hard times.
Yeah.
And it's like, well, I should hope so, because Laura had the most extracurriculars, that is, of anybody ever.
I know.
Girls' college, you know, applications would have looked real good, because we got Meals on Wheels. We have helping Johnny Horn... and
Josie tutoring Josie
in English, and then, well, is there anything else? Is there anything directly at the high school that I'm missing?
That I'm remembering right now.
I mean, obviously involved enough to be voted homecoming queen in the lives of the high
schoolers. I mean, there are some other extracurriculars that she wouldn't be writing on her college application.
Yeah, well, obviously. Namely, being involved in distribution of cocaine, it seems.
Yeah.
We get that look in the... Well, okay. You want to talk about their nicknames they have for each other, Mike and Bobby.
So ridiculous. So they call each other Bopper and Snake when they're in the jailhouse.
Yeah.
Bobby is Bopper and Mike is Snake. No one else ever calls them that. It kind of fades away.
It says a lot about the fact that, and also the fact that they are now $10,000 short and gonna be in the shit with Leo Johnson. It says a lot about how small time they are.
Oh yeah.
They're neither of them are the brains of the operation or the brawn even.
No.
But yeah, so we get that little confirmation, kind of filling in the gaps of this mystery thus far at this point, that they were involved in the distribution of this along with Laura, and that they were answering in some way or another to Leo. Mm-hmm. So
it's just like, Bobby, like, why, like, you know, Leo, you're like working with Leo, you don't have a great working relationship with Leo, why are you having sex with his wife? Why are you making that choice?
Well, I think so far all signs point to Bobby not being very smart.
You might be right.
And that's one
of
them.
We'll have to see how this unravels.
I don't think we need an explanation of why he's doing it. He's not the sharpest knife in the drawer.
That's fair.
He is not the star student of Twin Peaks.
Something else that I found a little weird, Laura's cause of death.
Yeah.
Blood loss from shallow wounds. That's not fatal.
Mm-hmm.
The only way that that could happen is over the course of, like, days where someone's, like, reopening a wound. Or if you don't have, like, the clotting agents in your blood, but...
Yeah. Well, the circumstances otherwise of Laura's death are very strange.
Yeah, and that's what I'm wondering, is if it's just, like, we didn't want to deal with it, so we didn't worry about it in the writing process... Or if it's supposed to be another, like, mysterious layer on her death.
I would lean towards the latter, personally.
Yeah.
Yeah. I would lean towards the latter. And this isn't entirely based off of things I know that you don't, or that the watchers who are watching along with the podcast don't know. I'd say that the way that that line is presented is also supposed to be like, that's, like... That's what the autopsy turned up. That's cause of death.
It seemed like Doc Hayward was strangely accepting of it, but he also didn't conduct the autopsy himself. So
he also didn't conduct the autopsy, and he also then breaks down.
He's
not doing so hot. You're right about Donna doing Laura very wrong right away. I do, one of the moments that stands out to me, it's like I'm living the most beautiful dream and most terrible nightmare all at once. That's a feeling I had a lot in college for various reasons. So, you know, there would be times when I'm scrolling through Tumblr and that pops up as a quote, and I'm just like, I feel it. I don't feel it because, you know, my best friend died and I then stole her boyfriend, but I feel it. I get you, Donna. I'm not a Donna.
Are you sure you're not a Donna?
I'm pretty sure. I'm a Pete. I think I'm a Pete Martell, who has his, I think, standout most memorable moment in the entire show this episode.
Yeah.
How did it get in there? How does the fish
make
it into the percolator?
Not unless someone puts it there.
Not unless someone puts it there. That's the new element of mystery that this episode introduced, and I want answers for. How did that fish get into that percolator? I think, you know, our lead suspects are Pete, in which case I'm not going to ascribe motive. I'm going to say that's just, you know, a flub. Could have been Josie. Now, I think at that point in the day...
Trying to serve her boy Harry some contaminated coffee.
Yeah. Yeah, could be. Oh, man, that's yet another instance of Cooper's just like...
weird omnipotence.
Yeah. Well, I mean, he says body language.
Yeah, but like...
But he gets it in one. He knows that Harry and Josie are fucking.
Yeah.
And we get, you know, you were talking about the Harry conspiracy theorists last week.
Yeah.
But, you know, this would be, I don't know if this would be more fuel for that fire. You know, they've been now seeing each other for six weeks, he says. And Andrew Packard died a while ago, like a year and a half.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of, looking at it this way, I don't know if it's sticking out to me more just because I'm trying to be, you know, more attentive to the seeds that are being planted. Or if because, like, now I'm at a different age and state in my life where the backroom stuff around the mill is like suddenly more interesting to me. Catherine and Ben's rendezvous put some more information on that story, but I don't know, just like I love that that's actually one of the elements. It cements it as a small town show, is the what's going to happen to this sawmill that's the source of employment for so many people in the town.
Yeah. And the fact that everyone is sleeping with everyone. There is not a single person in this town that is faithful to their spouse.
Yeah. You have a note about Ben here.
Yeah, I just think that he's gross.
He's gross. Just thinking he's gross. You have a note about his foot thing.
Yeah, okay. He like basically starts sucking on Catherine's toes at one point, which is nasty.
I think a brilliant move when you want to characterize put some stuff out there about the characters just through action on this network television show while also being lavicious and like I don't think you're supposed to look at those two. Actually, I will say Richard Boehmer, who plays Ben Horn, go look up pictures of him when he was a movie star, I guess in the 50s, 60s and so forth. He was a handsome man.
Oh.
He was a handsome young man, and he was cast as such. He was like, you know, a studly leading man type. And now he's Ben, who wears the creepy glasses and sucks on Catherine's toes. And, you know, like the whole staging that scene, the action of it, I think it does, it gets this kind of like, cringy, like, oh, I don't want to be seeing this. I don't like these people. These people are bad.
Yeah, but they're
on network television at the time.
Much concentrated power in that room.
Yeah.
They're basically trying to, like, run and destroy the whole town.
Yeah. So, big movers and shakers. Making some moves here in bed. Ugh.
Yeah. And then we move over to the Palmer house, which Donna is visiting to talk to Laura's mom while she's doing Laura dirty, as usual. And we get that...
I'm starting to get the sense here, as we record this, that you are somewhat anti-Donna?
I'm not... I just like
you're not team Donna.
I'm not team Donna, and I don't think
I don't know anybody who is team Donna, FYI. So yes. It's not like this is a
If you're watching for the first time, you may not understand why people don't like Donna. It will become clear to you through time, but for now, I just don't. Couldn't she just chill on the James thing until Laura's like buried or something? Maybe
no, evidently not.
But anyway. We get that superimposition of Cheryl Lee's face over Lara Flynn Boyle's face, which A plus effect for the time.
Yeah.
But very campy.
a limitation that I think still works. Like now,
there's
now
also
if
like
they...
a chunk of like Laura's blonde hair like attached to the superimposition.
You'll see this kind of technique. I feel like this isn't the only time it appears in the show. And the thing is that now, actually, if we want to talk revival and style and all this, if they were to pull that move again in the revival and it didn't look kind of janky, I might feel weird.
Yeah.
Like, if today they were to be like, well, yeah, we scanned such and such's face and then made a 3D model and then did face tracking all this so we could completely, like, replace it, I'd be like... Yeah, but now it loses something. It would lose something for me.
Yeah, totally. And it would lose the like really soapy aspects of the show that I think are really essential.
Yeah. Then again, you know, we're going to be moving to digital. Ostensibly, we're going to be doing widescreen. So maybe, then again, I could say maybe the opposite. Where if then it was just like, and all of the effects and little things done to convey story in the show are meant to look bad, you can fuck that up and then it just looks worse than it would have looked originally.
That's true. Well, not
I think
even
about
bad, just like dated.
I think about
dated.
You know, the like the 80s aesthetic, like action movie type thing that people try to imitate now because they're like, it's radical, it's time that we really appreciate it, and they like apply VHS filters to their movie and like do purposely bad effects.
True.
There's a way to make that just look awful and like idiots will eat it up. But that kind of like we're gonna make it this look this way for the sake of making it look this way shouldn't be the motivating factor for anything in the revival. It should be and I feel like this was the case when they made the show. they did that effect on Laura Flynn Boyle to show, like, the only reason why that special effect is in there at all, rather than just you just have a shot and she just starts, you know, crying out Laura's name or something. Something's up with Laura's mom.
Yeah.
And then right after this, it's like the cue in to be like, okay, what's, again, we're in the sense that something's up with the way that she's seeing the world.
Mm-hmm.
It's not just like, you know, the insertion of the flashback like we had earlier with James.
That's true.
You get the appearance of this dude.
Yeah. The mysterious figure at the end of the bed. One of the creepiest shots of all time. It always startles me a little bit.
Because they just cut to it. It's not like it's... I think now, you know, we can throw around like a different show would have done it this way all the time. But it's just such a bold decision to say, bam.
Yeah.
This is the shot. You, and I think you're set up for it by that special effect earlier.
Yeah,
like you get
totally.
The sense that this
you're
is
right.
what, you know, this is what she's seeing.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a scary moment. And we'll have more to say about that guy later.
Yeah. Frank Silva just really good at looking creepy without doing anything.
Right. Yeah. Well, I think that's how he got the part, isn't it? Another moment that we shouldn't leave behind that, and I think it's before what would have been a commercial break in the show, when they go and just, unrelated to anything seemingly, show the video of Laura from the picnic, and you get the help me overlaid over it. It's like, that's the kind of thing that I would feel I would really miss if it doesn't come back with the revival.
Totally.
And the thing that I feel like the show starts to, at a certain point, not do as well in these episodes, in the original run, is these moments where the story of the show comes through in a different way. It's not just coming through in the day-to-day, you know, narrative, like this scene, that scene.
Yeah, they're really making like cinematic, stylistic, aesthetic choices at this point to tell the story.
Things come in out of nowhere.
Mm-hmm.
To tell you that something else is going on as well.
Yeah.
We'll have more to say about that next episode on terms of where is any of this stuff coming from? Why are we getting this sudden cut to the video? Does this actually have some kind of... Can we tie that back into the plot, or is it purely a stylistic thing?
Mm-hmm.
We'll have some things for you yet. You got a ton of notes. We've been going for almost an hour.
I have a ton of notes.
Is there anything else about the mystery that we get out on the table that we really need to talk over today?
No, there's a couple of weird lines. When Shelley introduces herself to Cooper, he says, "Shelley Johnson with a J? What other letter is she spelling her last name with? What other spelling of Johnson does he know?"
G-H-O-N.
Johnson with a Y?
Just
like, if there are weird lines like that that just slip through, and it's not until you're like third, fourth watch that you start to be like, that line doesn't make any sense.
I, you know, back to my earlier grumblings about how Leo is right now very one-dimensional. We get his bloody shirt.
We do. We can come to that when we cover the All That TV boards.
Okay. Yeah. Leo theories.
Yeah. The other two things I wanted to bring up, though, Lucy talking about how she could tell it's a long distance call because of the open air sound.
Hmm.
That's not going to be familiar to a lot of current viewers.
No. Yeah.
What does a long distance phone call sound like? I don't know. It's a good question. And then Sheriff Truman makes this comment that he needs to start studying medicine because he's the Dr. Watson of this relationship. And it's a really overt commentary on like their dynamic. And it really tells you that like Truman's going to be way in the backseat for a lot of this.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't often think of this show as in that way being a take on the... Holmes-Watson dynamic.
Yeah, no, neither do I. What do you think of when TV shows so bluntly make, you know, hey, you can think of the relationship between these two characters in this literary reference way?
I'm fucking sick of Sherlock Holmes.
you're sick of that particular one. Okay.
Yeah. And I think that, like, at times it can be interesting, particularly if they're making reference to, like, other aspects of the work. But if you're using it as the shorthand to establish a relationship and a relationship dynamic, I think it's very lazy writing.
Okay. Anyway, moving on.
Yeah, so Alt.TV had a few theories about what was going on in this episode. There were only, I think, 4 or 5 posts because we hadn't really, the boards hadn't really picked up yet. Although this episode was second to Cheers in the ratings for the week. So this was another, lower than the pilot, but an overall high point in the ratings of Twin Peaks.
Yeah.
It's really only going downhill from here. One theory that someone posted, they had 4 theories for the killer. Everyone, okay. So it's a wide conspiracy to kill Laura.
Okay.
No one, so she ODs or she commits suicide. Huh. The log.
Oh, right.
The fourth one, and this is a comment posted in April of 1990. Spice? Was Spice around at this time?
Spice,
I think, I can only assume it's the Spice that we would think of. Is there another Spice?
Spice the,
like, an
hold on,
an OD on Spice synthetic marijuana.
Oh,
there was a whole thing about that a couple of years ago.
Okay, I'm pretty sure. No, are you not? Where my mind went is Spice is the name of the substance in Dune.
Oh, I haven't seen
that. I bet that person's just making a joke because David Lynch directed Dune.
That's really funny.
That's like one. Not sorry, I'm not up on the synthetic marijuana game. You know. Maybe that's just because I'm from the West Coast.
You shouldn't be.
I'm pretty sure that's just a goof. That's just a joke about Dune.
That's really funny, though, that I read that and I was like, who had synthetic marijuana in 1990?
Okay, you were concerned. Yeah, no.
I was concerned because
I'm more concerned about this guy's log assertion because, yes, we do get some more log lady in this episode in the diner, but I mean, the log's not done anybody wrong yet.
What do we know about the log?
I mean, well, the log will have something to say about this.
I know. Soon. The log saw something.
Yeah.
But Cooper needs to ask the log.
Cooper needs to believe in the log.
Exactly.
Which should have been printed on t-shirts at the time of the show.
Anyway.
Believe in the log.
So, basically, the consensus was kind of split between Leo, Bobby, and James are too obvious to be the killer.
Okay.
And the tracks are being laid. It's like a double red herring scenario where they're too obvious, but the tracks are being laid enough. And there were a couple of interesting things about Leo that I hadn't been thinking about. So the shirt.
Yeah.
And there's another shirt that Leo alludes to. He says, this is the second shirt that you've lost this year, or something like that, to Shelley. And there's obviously the other murder of Teresa Banks that occurred.
Yeah.
Earlier this year. So question being, could those two events be connected?
Leo is a trucker, so
travels a lot. There's also a lot of plastic wrap lying around his house.
Yeah, okay. Again, though, I just feel like that puts him more in the, like, you know, also just the scene of abuse where it's like, yes, he is a dangerous, terrible person. It's never in any show is it the person who is shown to be the most dangerous and terrible of the bunch the one who did it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's true.
So.
Yeah. And then
glad to see that people are like, you know, these are probably red herring things, because if the state of TV analysis in 1990 or whatever, it was just like, well, he's scary, he probably did it. Like, you know, people logging onto bulletin board systems, and then they would be like, my theory is that it's the one who, like, is very much an angry man. I'd feel really bad.
Someone proposed that it was Doc Hayward.
Okay.
Said that he was too good, too nice, kind of too invested.
All right.
People don't really advance the Sheriff Truman theory at this point. And then there was a very extensive argument about whether the cleanliness of the beach was realistic or not. Someone argued that if a body could wash up on a beach, there should also be, like, trash and, like,
more
used
debris,
condoms and stuff like that. And then someone said, no, I live in Washington. It's too cold to do that kind of stuff on a beach in Washington. And I think that that's pretty accurate.
Yeah, fair. Also, I mean, what are you going to do for your opening shot of your TV show? It's a hard sell to be like, you know, we're gonna take our actress, we're gonna like very carefully put sand on her face and give her the blue makeup and get her hair all messy in the plastic to create this striking image of this dead teenager's body, and then the rest of the set department's gonna make sure there's a lot of trash out on the beach. Like,
that'd be a different show.
Different show entirely.
At this point. And then a couple of other points that people brought up. I believe Truman asks Big Ed, "How's that coconut?" in response to like his head injury at the bar the night before. Mm-hmm. And then we start to see Jacoby's weird obsession with Hawaii and his like coconut with the secret compartment.
And the final moments of the episode, he is the one who dug out that necklace.
Yeah.
And he's got secret tapes from Laura.
I know. When the audio cuts, when he just puts the headphones on, that's another like moment of intense frustration. Like, mm-hmm. what does he know about Laura that nobody else knows?
Yeah. So no one was saying like Jacoby's gotta be involved somehow this week. On the boards?
Not as strongly as people were debating the merits of Leo or not.
Okay. All right.
But the other thing that people brought up that I think was interesting is the idea of there being multiple necklaces.
Huh.
So there being multiple necklace halves, particularly because it seems that Laura has or had multiple relationships with
That could
people.
Be. Yeah. Yeah, and maybe they're thinking, like, next episode we'll get another flashback where someone's just like, you smell good and your skin is soft. Click. Break necklace.
With Leo, with Dr. Jacoby.
We get a scene where Cooper goes into the Cooper goes into the Twin Peaks tchotchke shop and Laura just buys them out of all of their heart necklaces. Yeah, could be. Could be.
It's an interesting theory to advance because I think it's a lot... It's Occam's razor. It's really easy to read it as like, there's one necklace and we know where both halves are at
right.
this point.
That's true. Well, that'll do it for this week's episode, right?
I think so. It really leaves us kind of on a cliffhanger.
But next week is... This is the one that I would say, were I privileged enough to be alive and watching it at the time, like... Me now, transported back in time, I've not seen Twin Peaks, but I'm like, okay, I'll give this show a shot. The next week's episode happens, it would be, like, Lost all over again, or, like, 10 times worse, probably, in terms of, like, now I'm in it. Yeah. Now I want to know what it is.
You would be posting on the alt.tv forum saying, who has a tape of the previous episode?
Yeah, I would be. I would be typing away on an old computer, going nuts.
The other interesting thing is they can't, the people who are posting on the alt.tv forum about the possibility of there being multiple necklaces, they can't go back and rewatch it to verify.
Yeah.
They post and they say, like, does anyone have a VHS so they can pause it and try to see what sides of the necklace are accounted
for. So hard back then to be obsessed with a TV show to an unhealthy degree.
Yeah. I mean, it's one of those things where now TV shows have to be produced with such a high degree of detail. Like on the Better Call Saul podcast, they were talking about how because they shoot in digital, because people are using high-def screens, when there's like a newspaper sitting on the table, they have to type articles.
Yeah, it can't just be Lorem Ipsum or whatever.
Yeah.
I personally, as a fan, I would love to be... As a fan of that kind of junk, I would love to be the person who, on a production team, just has to come up with news articles and stuff.
Oh my god, that'd be so fun.
It'd be really fun. But anyway, that's aside from the point. I don't think we'll be doing much zooming in on newspapers like the Twin Peaks Gazette or anything. Different time.
We have the technology now, so we could do it.
We could do it, but I don't think we're going to find that much. Oh, look! Oh, the pilot, they identified who the killer was, and the newspaper just says so. It would have been over so soon, then, if people had better TVs and the ability to pause. All right, so it's time for our food review segment, I guess. This is going to be a thing, permanently.
Damn fine food?
Damn fine blank, whatever. This week it's coffee.
Yeah.
Appropriate. It will be coffee for like a couple different weeks, especially in this town.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of roasters to choose from in Portland.
Yeah. So you got this from Heart.
Yeah, so this is a Kenya origin and African beans. Well, taste it and tell me what you think you taste. What are the tasting notes
of this? I'm not really great with coffee tasting notes. Now this is from the it's the roaster and the shop itself.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Because, you know, say if we had just gotten like, this is some Stumptown coffee from such and such place, I could hear the coffee nuts being like, no, that doesn't count. You can't just get the beans and then like trust someone to make the coffee right. You have to then put in the effort yourself. But I'm going to trust roaster doing their own coffee, preparing it themselves. This should be up to their quality. What do I taste? If I were to start making up flavors, like if I were just to start naming anything, I could then take another sip and convince myself like, oh yeah, no, that's definitely in there. Yeah. That thing I just said.
I mean, I've seen coffee advertised as having marshmallow tasting notes, which is one of the wildest claims I've ever heard.
Marshmallow notes.
Yeah, I don't know what that would.
No, this one definitely tastes like marshmallows.
It tastes like marshmallows.
No, I mean, back at the cafeteria at our college, there was that one that was always described as buttery.
That's a real thing, though.
Yeah, but if you just have... Well, for one thing, their coffee, none of it was good at all. None of it was, like, flavorful in any way. It just tasted like bad coffee. And that might have just been because it was perpetually made poorly. But it was very thin. And so I never got buttery notes from it. Because it's just like, I'm pouring this down my throat so I can make it to 9 a.m. class. Yeah. What are the advertised notes then on this coffee?
I didn't see the advertised notes, but generally you have the three main regions of coffee. So you have Indonesia, South and Central America, and you have Africa. And there are a couple of distinct qualities of each region. So African coffee tends to be lighter and more floral. It's a really good like summer coffee.
Okay.
Yeah.
Hmm.
And Heart tends to do lighter roasts, so it's a pretty good pairing.
Well, you're the coffee expert, having run a coffee shop for a year. What is your opinion on this Heart coffee?
This is not my favorite Kenyan beans situation that I've ever tasted. But it's pretty good. I generally like Heart because they do light roasts. Whereas with a lot of roasters, I think people tend to go dark to cover up their own mistakes in the roasting process.
Well, so does it get your damn fine?
Yeah.
Okay.
Generally, Heart gets my damn fine seal of approval.
I'm gonna say
on a scale of fish in the percolator.
Okay.
To damn fine.
Well, this is a several heads above fish in the percolator, and I see no problem with it. I might just be biased towards darker roasts.
I think you are.
So, yeah, it's a possibility, and I'm sure that we'll, in the course of this show, sample one, and it may get my damn fine seal. But I'm just gonna say, between, you know, is it a lamplighter in or a double R or a great northern coffee? Given that the Great Northern gets Dale's seal in this episode, and I can think of the, you know, this is not, I'm not getting, you know, I'm not getting the black as night kind of feel. Or sorry,
did
what's
you
the
like that? Is that what you're into?
Well, it's what Dale's into, and given that he gives, you know, he gives that as his on the Dale Cooper scale. I'm gonna say this falls somewhere maybe a lamplighter. You know,
ooh,
you recommend it on the way into town, but it's not where you're gonna get coffee every day.
All right. We'll work on your taste.
Oh, okay. My taste needs work. It's you know, the point here isn't to come to a consensus.
I know.
There will be Matt and Ashley days. I hope not be a day where we, like, I don't know, get some pie or something and both of us are like, this is awful. We wasted our money on this. Don't buy. But there you have it. One damn fine and one
lamp.
Eh. we can be found on the internet if you want to talk to us about the show or, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah, so my Twitter is Ashley Brandt.
And my Twitter is Matthew Olson with one T, and Matthew, O-L-S-O-N. We can be found on Facebook. The name of our Facebook page is just...
Twin Peaks Peaks. You can find us at Twin Peaks Peaks on Tumblr. Yep. And on Twitter, and on Simplecast.
And on Simplecast, yes. That is where our podcast is hosted. You can download it direct from iTunes, though, which is also where you can subscribe. That helps out a lot. And leave reviews. That also helps out a lot. It will get us out there. It will get other eyes on our podcast. So please, please do it if you enjoy this. And if you enjoy it so much that you have ideas about what we could do differently, let us know.
Yeah, we want to cover stuff that you guys are interested in. There are a lot of different aspects of the show that we could cover in any given episode, so give us a shout.
All right, and do you remember what we settled on for our sign-off?
Don't forget to brush your teeth, Harriet.